Yeah, okay.
Hi, good afternoon. It's great pleasure and great honour to welcome Sarah Dibris McQuaid here today, former student at this university, or
yes.
Partner. Associate Professor in British and Irish History, Society and Culture at Aarhus. She's been visiting us for some weeks, and I think she's had an opportunity to meet a number of people in the room to progress her own research projects. And so it's really good to have her today. She was a founding member and a core research partner in the Centre for Resolution of International Conflicts at the University of Copenhagen from 2013 to 19. Her research pivots around how collectives remember, forget, and archive their past, particularly as part of conflict and peace-building processes. She's worked extensively in Northern Ireland and is currently, well, here at the moment, working on dynamics of multi-level memory governance, which is an interesting phrase, I think, where transnational, national, and local actors, processes, products and practices give shape to each other. She teaches in the English degree programme as well as the BA specialisation in conflict and narrative. And she also teaches in the MA in intercultural studies. It's kind of a fascinating combination of interests and focus, or foci.
Yeah.
Sarah is currently, as you know, visiting here at the Institute of Irish Studies, and we hope she will be back again. So her title today is Remembering the 1916 Easter Rising and the End of Empire, Transnational Templates of Irish and Indian Freedom Struggles. I think I'll move, because are you going to use the overheads, yeah?
Yeah.
Perfect.
Overheads, yes.
Have you got this?
Yep.
All right, thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here and also a little bit daunted by the company in the room. Thanks for coming. I have to say a few things. So yes, I was indeed a student here. I did the MA in Irish Politics in 98-99. I see Adrian is here, who's one of my professors at the time. I also did my PhD here. So the accent you're hearing is a Danish accent. My father was Irish, but I grew up in Denmark without him. So just most people wonder about the name relative to the accent. So that's that out of the way. All right, so usually, I speak to an audience who don't know the case of Ireland, but would know the theoretical framework very well. And here, of course, it might be different. So you might all know the case really well, which is Ireland, but not necessarily be as well-versed in memory studies, for instance, although I know, of course, quite a few people here work with that. So I actually had an introduction which kind of situated the decade of centenaries, but I don't think it's necessarily necessary to do it in this present company, and so I will skip over that. Any exchange students who would have benefited from that? No. Okay. So I'll just go straight to the body of the work. So 2016 was, as you know, the centenary of the Easter Rising, and in April of that year, I brought a group of MA students on a field trip to do participant observations of the commemorations in Dublin. Getting to my friend's house out near Kilmainham Jail, where the leaders of the Rising were executed, I asked the taxi driver, as one always does, like this is where you get to the fountain of truth, whether he was already tired of remembering the Rising. But he said not at all. On the contrary, he had enjoyed it immensely, with so many new aspects of the Rising being explored. I asked him what he had been especially impressed by, and he said the RTE radio documentary An Easter Re-Rising, about a 1930 uprising in Chittagong in pre-partition India, now Bangladesh, apparently modeled closely on the 1916 Easter Rising in Ireland. I downloaded the program, which was made by Pranjali Bhave, an Indian woman who had lived in Ireland for 10 years, and so the idea for this paper began to take shape. Often we think of immigrants as extrinsic to national commemoration. But increasingly, we see how national commemorative activities seek to integrate migrant communities and their histories. Crucially, centenaries are occasions in which almost all remembrance is disembodied, since none of the people who lived the historical experience are alive. and it may be re-embodied by new generations and populations through their participation in memorializing and imagining the nation. Whilst the decade of centenaries is about reaffirming and recharging and to some extent critically reassessing the national community, imperial and post-colonial relationships have also been pivotal points of renegotiation. And one dimension of this is how commemorations are used to position Ireland in relation to the imperial experience, which it may be understood to be both part of and subjected to. Another dimension is how commemorations are used to come to terms with other former colonial populations now living in Ireland. How do these communities themselves commemorate historical and cultural events, like independence and partition? And how are they and the transnational imperial past they represent incorporated in local and national commemorations? These were the kinds of questions that began to take shape when I listened to the documentary. There are crucial questions here, not just about what is remembered, how we remember, and who remembers together, but also what we might call remembering at different distances. That is, for example, how centenaries play out at different distances to violence in overlapping British and Irish memory cultures. While the centenary events are no longer part of living memory in the UK and Ireland, the conflict in and over Northern Ireland is, as is the partition of India and ongoing British military operations around the world. Different distances to violence can also refer to contemporary or historical views on violence as legitimate or not, that is, how much different actors are distancing themselves from violence then and now. A celebration of militarism in the past may be used to legitimize violence in the present, and that applies equally to state and non-state actors. And finally, remembering at different distances can refer to geographical distance, remembering the history of the place where you or your ancestors came from in a relocated context, so a form of long-distance nationalism. British India, undivided India, or pre-partition India, I am not sure of the cultural politics of these terms, but I'm sure they are political. That is, India before 1947, is of course a particularly interesting case because the motifs of independence struggle and subsequent partition are critical continuities in both India and Ireland and can be brought into commemorative context to undergird particular ways of remembering national pasts and project different futures. In brief, the documentary An Easter Re-Rising came about after the documentary maker Pranjali Bhave moved from her native India to settle in Galway in Ireland with her husband. She was initially quite worried about telling her family, and particularly her very Hindu nationalist grandfather, that she would be moving to Ireland. Much to her surprise, he was delighted when he heard where she was going, because he figured that the Irish were anti-colonial heroes and he fancied his own young self as a revolutionary on a bicycle like Michael Collins. So this is what she tells in the documentary. In this vein, the documentary begins to tell a story that weaves together transgenerational family memory and transnational history across India and Ireland. And indeed, Bhave uses her own family history as a springboard for learning about the history of her adopted country, Ireland, which then shines a new light on her country of origin and also makes her empathize with the older generation in her own family. In the documentary, she travels in time and space to trace Indo-Irish radical connections in transnational transfers of revolutionary methods and independence struggles. The centerpiece of these exchanges is what the documentary called An Easter Re-Rising, which took place in Chittagong in 1930 and in significant ways seemed to be inspired by the Easter Rising in Ireland, not just in giving shape to events themselves, but also in the way these events are then interpreted and memorialized over time. The Chittagong Rising is portrayed in the documentary in the following vein. On the 14th anniversary of Dublin's 1916 Rising, a group of revolutionaries called the IRA, the Indian Republican Army, undertook to reenact the Irish Rising in the eastern corner of British India. They had never travelled to Ireland, nor had contact with any Irish person, but they used like a manual Dan Green's book, My Fight for Irish Freedom, and other available fragments of Irish revolutionary literature to stage an armed rebellion unprecedented in Indian history. Is that unprecedented or unprecedented?
Either.
Thank
or
you.
Either.
Or either. I once had a friend who went for an audition and was going to sing You Say Potato, I Say Potato, but they only read it from the sheet, so they sang I Say Potato, You Say Potato. Anyways. And completely modeled on the Irish Easter Rising. It took place on Good Friday, which was surprising since it was not a Christian country. It took place in a significant part of the empire, Chittagong, which was an important port. It was a small group of people led by the teacher Surya Sen, and the strategy was to do an armory raid to seize weapons and take over key infrastructures of communication. Then announce a proclamation of the intention to assert the idea of Indian independence as set out by the Indian National Congress. The plan ultimately failed, and so far the similarities are obvious, but the aftermath was different. While all the leaders of the Easter Rising had been executed, only Surya Sen receives the death penalty, while others are imprisoned for comparatively short terms. And so these are the similarities and differences drawn out. We might also say that one, the Easter Rising, became a foundational event for statehood, while the other became a footnote in history. The documentary is quite explicit about its interest in migration and memory, but the kinds of migration at work are worth unpicking somewhat. At a basic level, the documentary posits that migration is at work in the historical events themselves. The rising, so to speak, migrates to India. Then history migrates back to Ireland as part of the commemorations around the centenary and is retold within a specific political narrative context. And finally, and significantly, it is brought back by a migrant who also uses it as a way to explore her own family history. These various levels are brought together in the documentary in ways that are suggestive for thinking more broadly about the ways in which transnational migration of memory works. Historians like Michael Silvestri, Kate O'Malley, Fergal McGarry, and others have all... done important work on mapping the connections between India and Ireland as part of making and dissolving the British Empire. And I don't want to question the importance of historical exchanges, like the ones sketched out in the case of the re-rising. What I do want to do is to make two key observations about what the transgenerational and transnational narrative in the documentary allows for. And here I had just borrowed some slides from Professor Ohlmeyer to also bring out some of the similarities. So these are the two proclamations, and what is highlighted there in yellow is almost copy-paste. and then these Fight for Irish Freedom translated into various languages in India by way of America, so often by way of American radical connections as well. So what does this allow for? So the first argument is very simply that the narrative in the documentary can afford primacy to violent struggle and thus work to maintain an interpretation of the Easter Rising in Ireland that has otherwise fallen somewhat out of vogue by displacing the history of the Rising to its repetition in Chittagong. And I'll return to this point in a minute. The second observation is that the documentary succeeds in complicating and pluralizing Irish history and contemporary society whilst flattening and reducing the history of the Chittagong Rising to one of Hindu nationalism. So in studies of nationalism, a foundational myth or a mythomotor is understood to be the inspiring narrative that gives meaning to the collective and motors a community of history and destiny. And in Ireland, many people have argued that the Easter Rising works as such a foundational myth. But the political cultural battle to seize control of this narrative has always entailed navigating tensions between constitutional and violent paths to nationhood and statehood, between celebrating independence and living down the partial birth of the nation as a result of partition. Importantly, since 1966, this navigation has taken place in the keel of conflict in and over Northern Ireland, and the shifting shapes of commemoration also reflect changing British and Irish relations in this context. The last couple of decades have seen very normative agendas for commemoration and memorialization emerge, often tied at once to templates of Holocaust remembrance, human rights, conflict resolution, and transitional justice. And Ireland forms part of this agenda in important ways. To give you one example, in a UN human rights panel where different nations described their good practices in memorialization processes, Ireland stated that for the decade of commemorations 2012 to 2022/23, which was important for the country, the government had adopted an approach to memorialization that was based on the principles of full acknowledgement of the totality of history of the island, the legitimacy of all traditions, mutual respect, and historical accuracy. The delegation explained that through a reconciliation fund, Ireland was providing support to a number of commemorative projects, some of which might challenge the notion of separate histories and explore how shared experiences could affect contemporary societal relationships. And clearly this mainly speaks to two traditions of unionism and nationalism, but it's couched in this very pluralist language. So looking at how commemorations of the foundational myth, the Easter Rising, has changed since 1966, it's clear that there's a general and accelerated move away from an antagonistic mode of memory. And here I'm breaking all the rules that I always tell everybody of my students, that I don't put a lot of text on a slide, but there you go. 1916 is no longer mobilized exclusively to support a traditional nationalist narrative, but now encompasses more complex and composite histories of allegiances across the British Isle, including narrations of the First World War. It's quite evident that the collaboration between British and Irish governments during the peace process in Northern Ireland are also manifested in acts of memorialization by coming to terms with a shared past between the two countries. The first step on this journey was taken with the opening of the Peace Tower in Messines in 1998 and firmly rearticulated in 2012 in a joint statement by former Taoiseach Enda Kenny and former Prime Minister David Cameron at the launch of the Decade of Centenaries. The statement recounted how the relationship between the two countries had never been stronger or more settled, as complex or as important as it is today, and anticipated that the Decade of Centenaries would offer the opportunity to explore and reflect in a spirit of historical accuracy, mutual respect, inclusiveness, and reconciliation. So we might say that Britain and Ireland have consciously moved from a form of competitive commemoration, as Ian McBride put it in 2001, in which only the sacrifices, glories, and dead of one's own side is remembered, to a form of commemorative commiseration, where it's possible also to remember and make sense of others, other histories, and even recognize one's own part in it. Still, there are limits to this in both parts of Ireland. There are no state representatives from the UK in the official commemoration of 1916. And in Northern Ireland, you might correct me on this, I'm not sure whether this is entirely true, funding to commemorate the two 1916s was split down the middle between unionists and nationalists in Belfast City Council. Is that right?
In theory, it didn't work out in practice.
Okay, well, we can maybe talk more about it. Yeah. All right. The centenary of 1916 and 2016 did not conform to one of these modes of memory. While some editorial decisions were made, the principle of pluralism could almost be seen as a free-for-all, as well as creating some space for multispectral reflection. There was a military parade celebrating the rising as a military moment. A memorial was erected with the names of all those who died, including British Army and police, much more cosmopolitan mode. There's been an increased focus on the role of women after some insistence, and the destruction of the city of Dublin and children as victims. And there's also been quite a lot of this globalizing the rising, which I think your project has been a huge part of as well. Okay, so the case I'm describing here, the documentary, bridges old and new ways, modes of remembering in interesting ways. It's clearly a new transnational mode of memorialization in the sense that Pranjali Bhave is migrating into Irish history, as Michael Rothberg would phrase it. That is, her background history is brought into official remembrance as part of the Decade of Centenaries in Ireland, aired on the national state radio. Also, the retelling of the story reverses the direction of the classic narrative of Irish transcontinental migration. Rather than focusing on the US to the west, the documentary moves east. A lot of these revolutionary connections were through the US. Having the story of the Easter Rising retold through a member of a relatively new immigrant community, and I know that it has a longer history, but in terms of density, at once reinforces the established narrative, but also opens up the possibility for its import to change. However, what seems to emerge is a relatively traditional nationalist interpretation of the rising, focusing on male martyrs and heroes, now corroborated and legitimized through a comparative case. Throughout the documentary, the necessity of moving from passive resistance to active resistance is underscored. Active resistance to British colonialism is equivalent with violent resistance, and the otherwise towering figure of Gandhi is sidelined to make way for revolutionaries like Surya Sen and Subhash Chandra Bose. The key figures of inspiration we hear about from Ireland are James Fintan Lalor, Patrick Pearce, Terence McSweeney, and Dan Breen. And the key ideas for recruitment to the cause are about armed revolt, blood sacrifice, and inspiring others to continue the struggle. In the beginning of the documentary, Panjali Bhave's grandfather is described as an extreme Hindu nationalist. And she says, "I had never sympathized with my grandfather's extreme radical views, but I had never tried to understand them either. On one level, the documentary works to help her understand him better by focusing on revolutionary objectives, but it also seems to end up largely condoning militant nationalism, even if there is a quip at the end about the place of violence still being discussed in India and Ireland. The sustained narrative is about Ireland as a beacon of rebellion and independence, and how violence focuses the imaginations in ways that constitutional non-violent methods do not. Getting back to my first observation, I would argue that this more traditional militant nationalist narrative, can only be kept alive in the contemporary commemorative context because it's articulated by proxy and displacement. The foundational myth of Ireland becomes told as if it were also foundational to India. The documentary explores a new context following the consequences of Irish history further afield, but displays little else of the more cosmopolitan reflexive modes of memory that have come to otherwise dominate remembrance in Ireland. We might argue that the primary function of the documentary for an Irish audience is not so much a celebration of violence as it is keeping a cherished narrative about inspirational male individuals and insurrection alive in a safer space. The most important contribution of the documentary, however, is showcasing the centrality of Ireland in the unraveling of imperial history, and to use this as a vehicle for reasserting nationhood and negotiating Ireland's place in the world. This is brought home in the opening vignette, where an Irish male narrator says, "When Irish volunteers rose up against British rule in the 1916 rising, they could never have imagined the impact their legacy would have on another British colony thousands of miles away from the streets of Dublin. And not just another colony, but Britain's largest and most valuable one. This colony was India, and today, as we commemorate the centenary of the rising, an Indian woman based in Galway tells us the story of this intriguing revolutionary connection." The introduction thus both casts the events of the rising as of global importance, but also marks Ireland itself as a global place where people from far-flung places might base themselves. My second observation is about how the documentary enriches Irish history through developing these transnational connections. Both in history and in contemporary society, by being narrated through an immigrant, while at the same time flattening the history of Chittagong and Bengal. This is Kolkata. The documentary practices what we might call dual side commemoration. That is, Pranjali Bhave interviews expert Irish historians on Indo-Irish connections, but also goes to India to visit her grandfather, who, from a memory studies point of view, now interestingly has dementia. And explore how this, so he can't really tell her himself about these events. So she explores how the events are remembered there. She visits a local museum in Calcutta, which was set up and is run by a voluntary group with rebel family connections. The various people she interviews there present the revolutionary history, which, as they say, have been pushed aside for a more constitutional narrative. However, as you may know, Chittagong, where the re-rising happened, is in what is now Bangladesh, or which was East Pakistan from 1947 to 1971, and Calcutta is in what is now called India. So here's Calcutta, here's Chittagong. So the rising happens here, she goes back to trace the memory of the rising here. The documentary does not discuss why the memory and the history of the re-rising is displaced from Chittagong to Calcutta, from East Bengal to West Bengal. The documentary doesn't discuss religion and only very briefly partition. The re-rising becomes a singular story about the fight for Indian independence, which does not engage any of the complexity inherent in any national movement or the aftermath of attaining the goal of independence, which is key to the politics of memory. Here, the family connections that enabled Pranjali Bhave's journey into history also marks the horizon of her retelling of it. Because, like, if you had been a complete outsider, you would not have gone back to Calcutta where your family was. You would have gone to the place where the events happened, right? The documentary does mention that Chittagong was an important port as part of the British Empire, but does not discuss how complex the site is. Chittagong sits at the crossroads of the Indian subcontinent and Southeast Asia. Apart from the anti-colonial rising in 1930, it was also an important base for Allied forces in the Second World War Burma campaign and hosts several war memorials. There's a Commonwealth War Cemetery there. And it was where the Declaration of Bangladesh Independence was made in the Liberation War of 1971. Furthermore, it's home to numerous indigenous groups for whom the choice between a constitutional or a militant route to independence is not necessarily the most relevant, and where indeed actually a peace agreement in the Chittagong Hill Tracts, which you see up there, was signed in 1997. All this melange is bypassed in the narrative by deplacing it to Calcutta and making it tell a singular history en route to Indian independence. If the point is to tell a streamlined story about how the Irish changed the world by inspiring the end of empire, then a complex, multifaceted narrative about Chittagong is, of course, a distraction. In this sense, the adage that transnational history is often pursued to enhance national history rings true. The ways in which migration is brought into contemporary memorialization here serves to underline the import of the historical events being commemorated. They inspired people as far away as India. It allows the retainer of certain classical themes in the commemoration of the Easter Rising by displacing the story east. At the same time, the documentary's use of migration works through an interweaving of family and national histories. This skips over a great deal of the complexity of Chittagong as a historical site in favor of this more singular and unabashedly revolutionary version of events. And this is precisely the kind of history that is no longer acceptable in an island that acknowledges the totality of history. In both of these senses, migration is used to shore up faltering narratives of the rising. However, it's also clear that the documentary at the same time remakes the rising into a more global and plural event. If nothing else, the very fact of Bhave's own migratory status redraws the limits of the Irish nation that the centenary events commemorate. And by drawing together memory and migration, the documentary thus combines a very traditional rendering of the rising with a fundamentally different project of nation building. And then I have some concluding Brexit remarks. just for Katie. Now, the interesting thing to me is that transnational history and memory in the Isle, and when I say the Isle, it's the Pococcian idea of the geographical entities of Britain and Ireland, is increasingly conceived as complex and composite with real potential for remaking relationships in the context of the peace process, where Britain and Ireland have worked closely together. On the other hand, transnational history and memory generated through and by South Asian migration seems in this case to enable more singular pasts as well as incorporation into more singular pasts by mobilizing new communities along religious lines. What I have described here, the comparative Indo-Irish experience of independence struggles, or the emergent history about the 400,000 Muslims that fought on the British side in World War I, First World War. Brexit has further fueled debates about imperial pasts and futures, and the whole process is tied closely to questions of migration, diversity, pluralism, and national identity. At the same time, Brexit is likely to occasion even more radical changes in political relationships across the Isles as borders re-emerge, or Northern Ireland may seek unification with the Republic of Ireland, Scotland might go for independence. And in this context, ongoing commemorative programs are highly transnational and multidirectional processes in which communities and nations at once pursue separate and overlapping agendas marked by political context. And I would suggest that we need to pay close attention to how these processes are woven together. That's it.